Good evening. This is Susan Sarachek with Radioactive Magazine at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Tonight, our guest will talk about America's entire mental health system, which needs improvement, including when it comes to serving marginalized communities. Today, I have as guests Kathy Costello, a licensed master social worker with over 45 years of clinical experience. Kathy has worked in hospital and outpatient settings, as well as mental health research, Western Missouri mental health, and Midwest research. She comes to this program with both clinical and administrative experience. Our other guest, Bob Grove, a grassroots organizer who supports health care as a human right and supports the adoption of Medicare for All. Hello, Kathy. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. Let's start with Kathy. You certainly have lots of excellent experience years under your belt. And there are so many mental health issues, substance abuse, disorders, minority mental health issues. The statistics say that in 2018, 18.9 or 46% people had a mental illness. That rate was higher amongst people of two or three more races. Historically, how has the mental health industry gotten to where it is today, Kathy?
Well, in the 50s, the mentally ill were housed in large institutions like St. Joe State Hospital. There was really no treatment at that time. There wasn't any medication. There was no specific treatment. We didn't know what caused their illnesses. And I'm primarily talking about schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And this was the way that we managed them. Then they came out with a couple of medications that seemed to really help the major symptoms that were dysfunctional for patients, like delusions, bizarre behavior, hallucinations. And at the same time, President Kennedy came out with the Community Mental Health Act of 1963, wanting to move mental health from central organizations to decentralizing it and putting it in communities. The federal government funded community mental health centers all over the country with all kinds of auxiliary programs, outpatient programs. Here in town, the Alcazar Hotel was one where the mentally ill lived. They had nurses who gave them their medication. People would go out from the center and give them their medication. They had bus passes to get around. It was an excellent program, but it was funded by the government for a short time, and then the state was supposed to take over with the funding. And after that, it began to decline because the state didn't furnish the same amount of funding. And then in the 80s, the insurance companies came out with managed care. Before then, physicians had made decisions on treatment. When insurance companies had managed care, they made the decisions on length of stay, what kind of treatment you could have, sometimes what kind of medication you could have. For instance, you may have to have physical therapy before you get an MRI. And that's resulted in a shortening of length of stays. Less care in general. And the costs have gone up and up and up. I've seen deductibles on insurance as high as $10,000. which makes it just not feasible to use their mental health benefits.
Right, right. That causes many people to go into medical bankruptcy, mm-hmm, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And Susan, that brings us to one of those marginalized communities you were talking about. When we discuss health care, specifically mental health, we have to look at our homeless. Our homeless community is one of the most at risk and most marginalized of any group out there. I believe that, I think, Kathy, you were telling me over 45% of homeless have a mental illness. You know, these illnesses, what'd you say, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, they're the third largest contributor to homelessness. So, you know, as we have this discussion, I would like to see us focus on the homeless as a marginalized community and what we can do to help them.
Well, that's a good point, because you're both saying is that the disparities that were occurring in the past few years, are they still with us in terms of the mental health? And how do disparities impact homelessness? My statistics say 564,700 people were homeless on a given night in the U.S. 25% of American homeless, 140,000 individuals were seriously mentally ill. Where do they live? Can we talk about that?
Sure. And, you know, Kathy just mentioned how the large institutions are putting the people out on the streets. Saw an article in the New York Times just recently that said in Berkeley, California, up to 1,200 people are living on the streets, and these are primarily half of them from the institutions, mentally ill, that have been, you know, put out of the institutions because the funding's no longer available.
In Missouri, the state institutions have all closed down at this point. The last one to close was Fulton State Hospital for the Criminally Insane.
Okay. What about Kansas? Are there any...
I'm not familiar with that. I think Osawatomie is still open.
Right. Okay. So, more about homelessness. Is homelessness associated with fewer psychiatric beds?
There are fewer psychiatric beds available. There are fewer providers available. The community mental health centers now have waiting lists, and the waiting lists are full. You can't even get on the waiting list. And you have to have Medicaid to get benefits. So it's left out, the poorest of the poor.
I think mental health is intricate and intimately intertwined with homelessness in many ways, and it affects us in both ways. If you're suffering from a mental illness, and under the current commercial health care systems we have, you can't receive adequate mental health. Either your commercial insurance doesn't cover it, or they find ways to not allow certain treatments, or maybe just financially you can't even afford health care because you're temporarily unemployed or you've had a major illness. These conditions where you can't get proper mental health care will often lead to you becoming homeless. And then the opposite scenario is, if you are homeless, the fact that you can't get mental health care, you don't have commercial insurance, you don't have, you know, a resident, you don't have a job that can provide you with insurance. As a homeless person, it's very hard to get health care, particularly mental health care, because, you know, mental health care, it's hard for anybody to get in this commercial industry we have. But, you know, for the homeless, it's hard for them to get the health care they need to reach a position where they can find a job, where they can cease to be homeless.
So you find that the chronically homeless are the mentally ill, the ones with PTSD, with bipolar disorder, with schizophrenia.
So you really touched on my next question. How easy, and I think you're both answering, how easy is it for the homeless to access mental health services? How do we fix this?
Well, at this point, the three biggest providers of mental health in the country are Cook County Jail, L.A. Jail,
Rikers Island, I believe.
And Rikers Island. There are no psychiatric beds for them. They end up in jail, and they don't get any treatment in jail. Often they don't get any medication, even if they go in with medication.
So even if they go in with a mental illness diagnosis, when they're in prison, they do not get medication. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Your question was how we fix this, and we've kind of been alluding. We've been talking about a commercial insurance system,
yes,
where the goal of commercial insurance is obviously to make a profit. We need a healthcare system that is a human right, that's universal, that's available to everybody without worrying about whether you're making a profit or not. We need to provide universal mental health care to the homeless and to everybody else in this country. We need to separate health care from the workplace. You shouldn't be getting your health care from your employer, because if you lose that job, you've lost your health care. We need to make health care a human right, not a commercial enterprise. Now, there's a lot of programs to do that. We've talked about single payer. You're hearing politicians talk about Medicare for all, universal health care. Those are ultimately our solutions to solve this problem. The United States is the only developed nation in the world that does not provide universal health care to their citizens. We can do better than that. We deserve better than that.
I think that's a good point. We deserve better than that. You are listening to KKFI 90.1 FM with Kathy Costello, clinical licensed social worker, and Bob Grove, grassroots organizer.
So can we talk a little bit about universal health care?
Please, why don't we talk about it?
I mean, it's got a lot of different labels. We've got an election coming up next year, so we're hearing a lot of politicians start talking about that. And it's an important platform. It's an important plank to all these platforms, and we all need to be aware of that. Let's talk about Medicare for All.
Okay.
Medicare for All is basically just the current Medicare system our parents have had for decades. Medicare, which I know my parents are very happy with it. They would not give up their Medicare for anything. All we're talking about doing with the Medicare for All system is opening that up so all people can become part of the existing system. We're not inventing anything new. You know, we're not making major overhauls we're not creating. We're taking an existing system that's worked for decades, and we're just making it available to everybody.
But doesn't that eliminate commercial health insurance?
It changes commercial health insurance. It doesn't eliminate it. So, for instance, your parents have Medicare for All. They'll have a secondary provider, and most times that's going to be a private insurance, so commercial insurance. Some people have opted for what they call Medicare Advantage, and in that scenario, the private insurance is their primary payer, and Medicare becomes a secondary payer. So there's still always going to be opportunities for these commercial packages to come in and work in collaboration with Medicare to provide additional coverage. And there were also opportunities for insurance companies to come and provide Cadillac packages. I mean, for the people that have that kind of money and they just want everything in the world, they can go and buy that. We're not shutting down the market at all. What we are doing is providing universal health care to everyone, the same level of service our parents have had for decades.
As a provider, I prefer providing Medicare because it is one plan instead of the hundreds of insurance plans out there, where each one requires separate paperwork, has separate rules, the bureaucracy and the red tape takes up more time than doing the therapy actually does. And, this would simplify the entire system, I think.
Have you, Kathy, I know you've worked in hospitals and in outpatient. Have you experienced, do you know what this looks like? I assume you do, what the problems with insurance looks like.
Oh, yes.
Tell us.
At this point, I only take Medicare.
Okay.
Like I said, there are hundreds of plans. Each one has their own set of rules. If you do not follow it to a T, you do not get paid.
Okay.
And it is a system, I think, that is set up to be more difficult to deal with. I don't know how. I suspect for patients, it's a little easier to deal with, but on the therapist end, there's more red tape.
Okay, thank you.
As we've mentioned earlier, I mean, obviously the commercial insurance companies are there to make a profit, so if they can find a way to make it harder for you to deliver service or find a way to not pay you for that service, they will.
So what are all the lobbyists and corporate insurance companies going to say if we, I know you said it's not a complete change, but what are they going to say about Medicare for All?
Oh, they're going to fight tooth and nail all the way to the mat. I mean, this is billions of dollars that's going to come out of their pocket instead of going into the CEOs and lobbyist politicians. I mean, we're taking all this money and removing it into actual health care. If you look at the amount of profit generated by the commercial insurance industry, it's staggering. It is staggering. And, you know, as Kathy said, in the 80s when they came up with this managed care system that allowed them to dictate what services people got and how much they got paid for it and how often they got it. Once they established that program and then started embedding it into our legal system, they created a gold mine. They had created an oil well that just kept pumping money to them. So when we look at the politicians, the progressive politicians today that are talking about moving to a Medicare for All, that are talking about eliminating commercial insurance as we know it today, not eliminating commercial insurance as secondary and Medicare Advantage. I mean, we still have those options, but certainly taking the massive amounts of profit out of insurance and putting it back into health care, that's going to hurt a lot of very rich people, and they are going to fight this very hard.
There actually is no mental health for the homeless.
That's just what I was going to ask you.
There are community mental health centers. Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example of one program that one had. I don't know if it's still in existence, but it was. They would send a caseworker out to get someone out from under a bridge and get them a bath and put clean clothes on them and take them for a job interview at McDonald's. And I don't know what the statistics were on the success of that program, but I doubt it. They were very high because you're not dealing with the mental illness there.
True.
And access to services. There are a lot of wonderful services siloed throughout the community. I recently was working with a homeless person and connected them with KC Care Healthcare. That's here in Kansas City, and you know it's a wonderful service. Please, if you have the need for that, check out their website, reach out to them. But even in that scenario for a homeless person, having the transportation to get to that service is an issue. You know, there are food pantries available. There are, clothing, free clothing places. There are places homeless can go, but they don't have the transportation to get there. Or maybe the healthcare clinic, in the case I was working with here, one of the things that they have to do is have proof of residence to receive services. So I'm a homeless person. How does that person prove they live within Kansas City to get the free healthcare services that are available to Kansas City citizens? It's a real conundrum.
It is a real conundrum.
Universal health care would fix that, wouldn't it? It's mm-hmm. no longer attached. Your health care is no longer attached to your workplace. It's no longer attached to where you live. It no longer requires a large premium every month. If you live in the United States, you get health care. And whether you're homeless or a normal person like me that just needs health care but doesn't make a lot of money, it would be there for us. And we all deserve that.
And to repeat again, how is this all going to be paid for?
You look at the amount of money that is wasted on the health care, and waste is the wrong word. It's profit. There's so much profit for the executives, the administrators, the stockholders in the medical industry. Going to the Medicare package that our parents have, if we make that ubiquitous and everybody has that, all of that profit can be rerouted into the healthcare industries. The other thing we can look at is simplification of the processes. As Kathy was talking, with hundreds of plans and an equal number of different rules and EAPs and qualifications, you know, that takes a lot of overhead. So a lot of money's being spent to maintain this very complex bureaucratic commercial system. Now, we typically like to use the word bureaucratic on government agencies, and certainly there is a degree of bureaucracy there. But I would rather be dealing with one bureaucracy that we have some control of through our election process than dealing with thousands of bureaucracies that have no oversight whatsoever.
Yeah. So really what you're both saying is that Medicare for All would certainly be a big help to the homeless.
Yes.
I mean, you've said that. Kathy, as a provider, and I think you've really answered this, because the question is, how would you compare a Medicare for All system to your current commercial insurance system? And I think you've really touched on that. You've had... Do you want to say anything more about that?
No.
Okay. I do think you both answered that.
I think an important element there that we should address for providers, because Medicare does pay somewhat less than commercial, not a lot, but, I mean, the government is establishing a rate, and you will hear a lot of the opponents to Medicare for All system touting that as providers will get paid less. It's a marginal less fee, but at the same time, it's simplifying the the bookwork, the administrative costs, the time. Kathy, how much time do you you said you're Medicare totally now, so you don't do commercial. When you were doing commercial insurance, how much of your time went to just administering all those commercial plans?
I would estimate that the paperwork, et cetera, was an hour of therapy and an hour of that.
So 50% of your time is going to non-paying,
even more.
So, and
phone calls, et cetera.
So Medicare may pay you less per hour, but you actually get more billable hours at the end of the day. So you could make more money as a provider. The other thing we hear them talking about is the death panels and that kind of stuff. And, you know, we should just ignore that. We're all adults. We're smart people. We know that that's just scare tactics. The thing to keep remembering is that Medicare for All is the same thing our parents have been doing for years. And I know that my parents have never appeared in front of a death panel. You know, they're still around and kicking. And, you know, they're happy people. They like their health care.
And we all agree that something has to be done with our mental health programs. There are more suicides occurring now than ever. Substance abuse is very high. So I guess the question, the last question is, so what do we do? What do we do about this? You're saying Medicare for All would solve a lot of these problems.
Medicare for All or universal health care. We've got an election next year. A lot of the candidates are proposing variations of this, and you know, I'm not here to say which one's best. I mean, to me, any of them would be a huge step forward. What we can do as individuals is we can start listening to what the candidates are proposing. We can become educated in what a universal health care system looks like. We can read about Medicare for All and just keep an open mind. That's where we ignore the things like the death panels, and they're going to take your insurance away. You know, we can basically realize that we're just taking our parents' health care system and making it available for everybody.
And with Medicare for All, the homeless can access health care. We regard, if you aren't working in the society, then you don't have a place. But every life is valuable.
Absolutely.
And they would be able to get treatment.
Absolutely.
So I'd like to encourage our listeners to support universal health care as a human right, you know, to listen to the candidates and vote for those that will support health care for everybody.
And I think what Bob and Kathy are saying also is that caring about health care and mental health care is an opportunity to share the importance of care in our relationship to others, in mental health treatment and services, and support and education to millions of people, families, caregivers, and loved ones affected by mental illness. Demonstrating how and why we care brings more awareness by showing our actions and connections to others. Care has the power to make life-changing impact on those affected by mental health conditions. Good. I want to thank Kathy Costello.
It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure to have you, licensed social worker. And Bob Grove, grassroots organizer.
Thank you for giving us this time.
I want to thank you both very much for a very informative program. Thank you.
And I want to thank Susan Sarachek as well as Bob Grove and Kathleen for a very informative show. I'm going to give you a heads up on a couple of things coming up. I'm going to give you a community calendar. And on next week's Radioactive Magazine, Dr. Fred Whitehead is going to be talking about populism and kind of the history of populism dating back to the Gilded Age and how current day politics around the world actually are affected by a different kind of populism, and whether it should be called populism at all or not. That's going to be our subject next week. It's going to be an interesting discussion, I can promise you that. Also, I wanted to let you know about a project that we've just started here at KKFI called Community Voices. And what we're going to be doing is recording people, probably maybe quite a bit like you, that are out in the community and doing things, people that are socially active or who's involved with social activism to improve the world, people involved in nonprofits, or people that just are doing any kind of interesting volunteer work out there. Our idea is to record a 2 or 3 minute monologue from these folks telling us what they're doing out there. So if you have any ideas for someone you think should be involved with that, give us a call at KKFI and tell them to pass that contact information along to Bill Claus. Okay, some things coming up this week. Tonight, Kansas Sierra Club and the Green Drinks KC presents Water Issues in the Kansas River Basin. That's tonight at 6:30. So 6:30 to 8:30. So if you take off now, you can get there anyway. It's at 7039 Mission Road, Prairie Village, Kansas. Also on Wednesday, tomorrow night, from 5:30 to 8:30 at the Press Penny Tavern, 1511 Westport Road, NextGen Advisory Board represents a group of community leaders made up of folks under the age of 40, that leaves me out, committed to the Midwest Innocence Project's mission. So check that out tomorrow night at the Pressed Penny Tavern. And then on Friday, August 16th, 17th, and 18th is the Ethnic Enrichment Festival at Swole Park. The address is 6600 Swope Parkway, but you know where Swope Park's at. Anyway, it's all day long, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, so check it out. And on Monday, August the 19th, at St. Mark's Hope and Peace Lutheran Church, 3800 Troost, at 7 p.m., Surge KC presents Understanding and Disrupting Racial Capitalism. So keep your radio turned right here to KKFI. Coming up soon is going to be Counterspin, followed by Taste of Tejano, after the following message.
Hello, this is Joseph Jackson, host of Cowtown Conversations, where we discuss matters that impact your life as a resident of the Kansas City metropolitan area. Thursday mornings at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now! Tune in for our next episode as we continue our conversation about crime in Kansas City and the metropolitan area, and we'll be talking about domestic violence in Kansas City. So join us on Cowtown Conversations, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Spitzer from American Roots. Listener-supported public radio is your number one source for news and information. And, dare I say, great programs like American Roots, with blues and jazz, roots rock and soul, country and gospel, Cajun and Zydeco, Tejano and Latin, and more. Public radio is free for the hearing, but costs to produce. By supporting your station, you're supporting the entire public radio community and American Roots. So act now before it's too late. And as we say in New Orleans, please give till it feels good.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, listeners may have heard about the electronic soap dispensers whose light sensors can't detect black skin. Google and Flickr's automatic image labeling that, oops, tagged photos of black people with ape and gorilla. An Asian American blogger wrote about her Nikon digital camera that kept asking, did someone blink? And you can, I'm afraid, imagine what turns up in search engine results for three black teenagers versus three white teenagers. Some examples of discriminatory design are obvious, which doesn't mean the reasons behind them are easy to fix. And then there are other questions around technology and bias in policing, in housing, in banking that require deeper questioning. That questioning is the heart of a new book called Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code. Counterspin spoke with author Ruha Benjamin. She's Associate Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and author also of the book People's Science, Bodies and Rights on the Stem Cell Frontier. Ruha Benjamin, today on Counterspin. That's coming up, but first we'll take a very quick look at some recent relevant press. Some 40 million people in this country use fitness trackers or smartwatches that monitor their heartbeat. It's a cultural phenomenon. Both the New York Times and Washington Post reported earlier this year that employers are increasingly using such devices to monitor, or you might say surveil, workers' exercise in hopes of cutting healthcare costs. But neither outlet has shown interest in findings reported late July on STAT, the tech and health issues website, that nearly all of the biggest makers of wearable heart trackers use a technology that is less reliable on dark skin. There have been consumer complaints, and while the researchers and scientists STAT spoke with made clear that there isn't a lot of research into the heart trackers themselves, the green light technology they use and its relationship to melanin is well documented. So much so that more research and more public information from manufacturers, who generally do not disclose concerns about accuracy, would be needed to make a case that there isn't a problem here. Of course, there are serious implications, not just for those monitored employees, some of whom have insurance premiums and vacation days pegged to their use of these devices, but for the growing amount of research, including medical research, that uses this data. But so far, the reporting by Ruth Hailu, an intern at STAT and a college student, has been picked up by tech sites, and that's pretty much it. So big media will still tell you what color Fitbit you might buy, just not what color you might need to be to use it. There are efforts to require companies to determine whether their algorithms discriminate, including a bill introduced to Congress this spring called the Algorithmic Accountability Act. It would call on some companies, especially those whose decision systems have a high impact, to conduct impact assessments, pushing them to think more deeply about design. But as an op-ed in the New York Times noted, the legislation relies for enforcement on the FTC, not famous for enforcing settlements, even with repeat violators. It lacks an avenue for public input, as in the Fitbit case, sometimes the first way we learn about these problems, and companies are notoriously cagey about proprietary information. But without mandated transparency, the legislation doesn't guarantee that anything learned would actually be incorporated into policy discussions. A start, then, but far from enough. We're talking about code on the show today, and in a way, news itself is a kind of code. A machinery or system seen as objective or neutral that gains power from that perceived neutrality that nevertheless reproduces and advances inequity. It works in many ways, one of which is trivializing or ignoring the way people of color are overlooked or an afterthought, including when it involves something as significant as our health. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Thank you. as a media critic in the 1990s, you could reliably expect every talk about the censorious effects of elite media's corporate and state fealty to be met with the question, but what about the internet? There was an earnest desire to see the power inequities reflected in corporate media, the racism, sexism, class, and other biases designed out of existence by some new delivery mechanism. You could say the same desires, denials, conflicts, and questions are writ large in U.S. society's engagement with technology generally. Even as we see robots and algorithms replicating the same problems and harms we have not conquered societally, there's a kind of insistence that technology is a kind of magic that of itself can get us somewhere we can't get on our own. A new book interrogates that belief and the effects of it. It's called Race After Technology: Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code. Author Ruha Benjamin is Associate Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and author also of People's Science, Bodies and Rights on the Stem Cell Frontier. She joins us now by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome to Counterspin, Ruha Benjamin.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, I mentioned at the very top of the show things like electronic soap dispensers that couldn't detect black skin or a camera that thinks that Asian people are blinking. Your book cites the classic Alison Bland tweet about Google Maps telling her to turn on Malcolm 10 Boulevard, though you talk about how that was seen really as an engineering victory to get a computer to read a Roman numeral as a number. Some discriminatory design problems are easier to explain or harder to deny, I guess, than others, like where you see this presumed neutrality of whiteness. But part of the hurdle of engaging the questions that you engage in this book is that it involves understanding racism after, as before, technology as not having to do with intent or with intentionality. You have to kind of dig very deep to even start the conversation, don't you?
Absolutely. I think for many people, as much as we're becoming accustomed to talk about and think about implicit bias, for many people, racism is still really about interpersonal interactions. It's about racial slurs, it's about hurt feelings. And so it's hard to understand patterned behaviors, the institutional, the legal, the policy level forms of racism that don't rely on malicious intent. Of course, oftentimes that is still in the mix
right,
for many things. But, you know, it's really difficult for people to zoom the lens out and think in a more patterned, systematic way. And I think once we do, however, it becomes much easier to understand how technology is part of the pattern. It's one of the mechanisms, in addition to laws, in addition to economic policies, in addition to, let's say, redlining, housing, discrimination policies, to see that technology is one of the facets that we have to take into consideration. But as you say, a very simplistic understanding of what racism is prevents that jump in many ways.
Well, one of the things that I found frustrating when I cite that, you know, what about the internet example, was the relief that I could hear in people's voices. You know, we don't have to deal with all of that systemic unfairness you just talked about because the internet is going to flatten it all out, you know.
Absolutely,
you know, I have a lot of hope for the internet, but it was that sense of the inevitability that was dispiriting. But the power of technology is very seductive in what we imagine it could be used for. And I just wonder, where do you start, folks, when you're trying to explain, for example, what you're getting at with the term the new Jim Code? You know, you've just moved toward it, the continuity there. Where do you start, folks, out?
As you say, there's a real hunger for many people, especially those who benefit from the design of our current systems, to want to bypass and jump over the difficult work of actually wrestling with these histories and ongoing forms of deeply embedded discrimination, bias, racism, white supremacy that infects all of our institutions. And so to the extent that technology offers a really alluring fix to jump over that and not really get in the mud of our history, it becomes something that people jump to. The internet is going to save us, or some new app is going to save us. And so what the new Jim Code intends to invoke is this history of white supremacy, racism in this country, to say that we cannot fully understand what many people call machine bias or algorithmic discrimination, which are still softening terms when it comes to white supremacy, unless we actually go through the mud of this history. So it's basically saying we can't take an ahistorical approach to technology's role in sedimenting forms of inequity and hierarchy. We have to go through this history to understand the present.
Well, just talk about some of the instances. The book looks at different kind of shapes of this. Some are designs that are kind of actively amplifying existing inequities. Some are things that are just not noticing them and thereby replicating them. What are some of the instances of this kind of algorithmic machine or embedded bias that folks might not be aware of?
So I'm talking to you from Los Angeles, which I don't live here now, but I grew up here, so I come back on a regular basis. And the way that I open up the book and the preface is just to kind of go back to my childhood growing up in South Central Los Angeles, which is and was a heavily policed part of the city in which helicopters could be heard rumbling overhead at all hours. You know, routinely police were pulling over my classmates and frisking them on the gates of the school. And so this is what Michelle Alexander would say is one tentacle of the new Jim Crow, this mass incarceration in which specific geographies in our country are targeted in terms of policing, whereas where I studied for a couple years in Westwood, you know, all kinds of things are happening behind closed doors in these neighborhoods that never see the light of day. And right. So that is one mode of white supremacist institutional racism in which police are targeting some areas and another. Now, fast forward to the present, where people, companies, organizations are employing all types of software systems to predict where crime will happen in order to more empirically, we're told, more neutrally, objectively, send police to go, right? Predictive policing type of programs. But these software systems rely on historic data about where crimes happened in the past in order to train the algorithms where to send police in the future. And so if historically the neighborhoods that I grew up in were the target of ongoing over-policing, surveillance, then that's the data that's used to train the algorithms to send police today under the cover of a more objective decision-making process. And this is happening in almost every social arena. Policing is just one of the most egregious, but it's happening in terms of education, which used to label high risk, for example, in hospitals, in terms of predicting health outcomes, in terms of which people to give home loans to or not because of defaulting in the past. And so our history is literally being encoded into the present and future. And the real danger that I try to highlight in the book is that it's happening under the cover of a kind of a veneer of objectivity in which we're less likely to question it because it's not coming from a racist judge sitting in front of you or a racist teacher who's doing something. They're turning to a screen that's producing some result that says you are high risk or you are low risk, you know, and then they're acting on that. And so I really want us to become attuned to this intermediary that is not, in fact, objective in the way that we are being socialized to believe it is.
You know, when you break it apart, it doesn't seem that difficult to see the flaw in something like predictive policing. If police are deployed disproportionately to poor communities of color, then that's where they make the most arrests. So if you fill a database with that and then you say, you know, Alexa, where is the most crime based on the number of arrests? Well, it's going to circle you right back to the data that
You fed it, and it's only predictive because you make it so. But people generally understand the idea of garbage in, garbage out, don't they? And what is it where there's resistance to understanding that there's a problem with this?
That's a great question. And, you know, as someone who spends all day teaching classes on this, you know, part of the conceit of just being an educator is if only people would just, you know, here's the data, you know, and that will lead to certain conclusions. And what we know is that the numbers, the dots that we're trying to connect, they actually don't end up speaking for themselves in the way that we hope, because people filter the story or filter the data through all types of interpretive lenses. So here I'm thinking about some colleagues up at Stanford who produced a series of studies both in California and New York in which they presented white Americans with data on racial disparities in the criminal justice system. And they showed them the much higher rates of imprisonment of black Americans and then asked them whether they would be willing to support policies that would address that. In California, would they be able to support, you know, reforms of the three strikes law? And in New York, whether they would be willing to support changes to the stop and frisk policy. And the researchers were quite surprised to find that the more data that individuals were exposed to in terms of the disparities, they were less willing to support the reforms. And so at some point between the data and the conclusion of the policy, people are filtering this information through all kinds of stories and interpretive lenses. One of the most powerful is that, well, if there are more black people in prison, then they are more criminal.
Right.
And they actually deserve to be there. And so why would I support reforms to laws that would actually endanger me?
Right.
And so we can sort of take that to the realm of predictive policing. Many people will be hearing the same dots that we're trying to connect in terms of garbage in, garbage out, historic over-policing, you know, the faults of future predictive policing, and they're not drawing the same conclusions as we are. That historic over-policing was justified in the minds of many. Thereby, the future predictions, we should definitely be acting on them and actually incorporating them in many more locales in order to safeguard their own neighborhoods and their own safety.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just looking to the flaws of the technology is not going to save us and is not going to help us reach certain conclusions if the political stories that we're telling, the social stories that we're telling, if they themselves are so infected by white supremacy that it distorts the conclusions that people draw.
I would say it means people don't even understand what you are saying when you say disproportionate. You know, I think we have to explode that term for people because they just don't hear it in the way that it's said. Well, there's every reason to focus on white supremacy, and it's maybe easier to convince folks of that than it has been for a minute. But it's also true, as you illustrate in the book, that in some ways, black people are canaries in the coal mine when it comes to this kind of technological, I don't even know what you want to call it, malfeasance or harm. It goes beyond racism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, so there's a way in which we can think about how the groups that are first experiencing harm or neglect in any kind of inequitable system, how we should be learning from that, you know, that experience. So in some ways, and what I try to sort of, the dot I try to connect is that black communities are already living in the future of a tech dystopia.
Right.
When it comes to policing or when it comes to all kinds of algorithms that are making life and death decisions. And yet, in part, because blackness and black people are already in the kind of collective imaginary, disposable, thereby those lessons are not being learned, you know, and so we're not actually seeing it coming in many ways. And so I'm hoping that through engaging in more, not just conversations, but the kind of organizing that's happening around tech justice in many locales, including here in LA, throughout the country, I think that we have to turn more to some old school forms of political organizing rather than look for kind of tech fixes and tweaks around the edges to address the new Jim Crow.
Well, that was going to be my next question. So much work is happening here. San Francisco and Oakland banning facial recognition technology. Amazon and Google workers protesting their own bosses' collaboration with ICE. And then groups like, you know, Center for Media Justice and Center on Privacy and Technology doing their thing. Are people grabbing it by the right end, do you think? Is the pushback radical enough? What more needs to happen?
I definitely think that there's a strand of the organizing that is really thinking in terms of fundamental reorganization of our relationship, society's relationship with technology, with tech industries. And so there's a lot of great things happening, some of which you mentioned. And we can think about, in addition to organizing, there's a growing critical legal community that's thinking about how do you litigate algorithms.
Right.
And so there's a growing movement among legal scholars. As you said, there's legislation being passed. And then there's just really kind of popular education examples that are happening. There's a wonderful organization here in L.A. called Color Coded that does a lot of community workshops along with Stop LAPD Spying. In every locale, whoever's listening, I'm sure you could find a group or organization working to deal with this at a very fundamental level. And so, you know, towards the end of the book, I try to draw some simple contrast to help us discern the difference between a tech fix, something that on the surface seems like it's a solution or thinking about addressing bias, versus a much more fundamental questioning of not just the technology, but the infrastructure and the society in which the technology is being deployed. Because if you have just a tech fix that is still operating and circulating within the same structure, then that means that the power hierarchies are not being challenged. And so we look at just two different apps that are trying to deal with mass incarceration and imprisonment. There are some that are really just filtering more investment into mass incarceration and the prison system, and some that are actually being used to get people out of cages and have a much more abolitionist approach to the process. And so I think we have to become much more discerning when we're presented with a solution to really look beyond the surface and think about the social infrastructure that solutions are being proposed in.
Finally, you talk in the book about reimagining the default settings as a key idea, and I'm guessing that this is part of what is explored in the new collection that you've just edited out from Duke University Press called Captivating Technology, Race, Carceral Technoscience, and Liberatory Imagination in Everyday Life. I wanted to ask you finally, what's liberatory imagination? Tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we think about where the solutions lie, where the problems lie. We're more or less trained to look to policy, to laws, even to organizing. And through that idea of liberatory imagination, I want to draw our attention to the way that even before you materialize some technology, there's an imagination that engenders that as an object. There are ideas, values embedded in our material infrastructure. And as of now, there's a very small slice of humanity whose imagination about the good life and a good world are being materialized. And the vast majority of people, they are creating, they are imagining, but have far fewer outlets in which to materialize. The fact that we need creative solutions that, in, on one hand, looks like artists and humanists getting involved. You know, many people hear a conversation about technology and they think, well, I'm not a tech person. That we're trained to opt out. We're socialized to think of some people as having the expertise to engage in this discussion and some don't. But the fact is, these things are impacting everyone, and that means everyone has the right and the prerogative to weigh in and to say, we don't want certain things. We don't just have to tweak the edges. We can actually have a kind of informed refusal. And so liberatory imagination is about reclaiming the space to say that we're moving beyond critique. We can critique and we need critique, but the counterpart of critique is that we want to be creative in terms of presenting alternatives to the techno status quo and materialize the kind of world that will actually be liberatory, in which everyone can flourish and realize their potential. And so I want us to make space for that in addition to critique, and I point to a number of examples of people already doing that, and I'll just kind of maybe close with one. It's a kind of parody project, going back to our conversation about predictive policing, in which a few people got together and said, what if we turned this idea of predictive policing on its head and had a white-collar crime early warning system and create heat maps of cities all across the country and predict where crimes of capitalism are likely to occur. And you would have an app that when you go into a city, it will alert you, and then it would create an algorithm to predict the average face of a white-collar criminal. And the designers of this used 6,000 profile photos from LinkedIn, CEO photos, so that the average face of a white-collar criminal is white. And it's funny on one level, but it's not, because we know that the same types of technologies are targeting darker-skinned people, Black and Latinx communities. And so this is a way of using art to actually reflect on the reality that we're creating right now and think about where the harms are being monopolized and centered. And so I guess the last thing I would say in terms of the default settings, so many of the technologies that are being developed now are about predicting risk, whether it's risk in who will be a risky person to loan money to, whether it's risk in terms of criminal risk, all the different domains of risk. And what changing the default settings would look like is, let's shift away from thinking about risky individuals to how risk is produced by our institutions, by our policies, by our laws. And so let's look at the production of risk rather than the individuals. And if we're going to predict anything, let's look at how schools create risk, hospitals create risk, police create risk, rather than the individuals. And that's flipping the switch on how the settings of our technologies are really burdening individuals rather than actually holding institutions and organizations accountable.
We've been speaking with Ruha Benjamin, Associate Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. The book is Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code. It's out now from Polity Press. Ruha Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The website's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network, to learn about subscribing to our newsletter, it's called Extra, or to show support for the show, if you're so inclined. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Coming up next, Taste of Tejano with Viviana, Tommy, Monica, Missing Sarah.
Damas y caballeros, de parte de todos los miembros del Grupo Momento, es con un gran honor and with great respect que les traemos un poquito de some of our favorite artists who have inspired us throughout the years para traerles nuestra música. Para todos ustedes, a taste of Tejano.